Hi, and welcome to the Provider Podcast. I'm Susan Ball. We're looking at trailblazers for the 10-year health plan, trusts that have managed to set the pace on progress towards the big vision of shifting care from hospital to community, treatment to prevention, and analogue to digital. Set out in a sentence like that, it sounds so straightforward, doesn't it? But like so many things in the NHS, it's anything but. Big strategic plans pointing the service at these goals have come and gone. We've seen progress here and there, but what the NHS is being asked for now is transformation everywhere all at once. And that's alongside more immediate pressures on emergency care, elective recovery, and rapidly rising demand for mental health and community services. Oh, and of course, money. A relentless financial squeeze and pressure to pick up productivity. The NHS landscape is mixed and varied. There's no single blueprint for success, but in our Providers Deliver mini-series, we look at and celebrate examples of what's working well, sharing lessons that have shaped that success. Over these three programmes, we have five case studies of different types of trusts that are heading in the right direction. But first, an overview with NHS Providers Chief Executive Daniel Elkles. I asked him, given all the formidable challenges and a checkered record on transformation, are the ambitions in the 10-year plan achievable?
So the best thing about the 10-year plan is that it's painting a vision of how we want the NHS to be going forward. And it's a very long time since we've had that vision. And what's really positive about the vision is that just about everybody agrees with it. So the level of engagement that got us to create it was really strong. The place we're trying to get to is a place everyone wants to get to. The challenge is, if you read every page of the 160 odd pages of the document, there's at least one thing that it says we're going to do. In fact, in several parts of it, every sentence is a new thing to do. So the advice that comes to my mind is from a former, when I was a much younger manager, Chief Executive Peter Homer at St George's, and he said, Daniel, he said, you can never deliver everything. What you have to ensure is that the things you do are steps on the way to the place you'd like to go to. And the more steps you can take on the journey of the place you want to go to, the better you're going to get to the outcome. And that is success. So do I think everything in the whole 10-year plan is going to be delivered in 10 years? No. Do I think we're going to make a lot of progress on a lot of it? Yes. And will the NHS be better as a result of that? Yes. So it's a good thing.
So you mentioned there that some of it is obviously achievable, but if you had a starting point and there were three top priorities to get down, what would you pick?
The three top priorities? Well, a big game changer will be patients having much more control over their own destiny. So giving them access to their medical record. Secondly, the whole concept of the neighbourhood and how we actually deliver much more care, not in a hospital setting, but centred around where people live and their contact with the local NHS, I think is really important because it's in people's communities and in their lives that you can most influence their health and their ability to look after themselves better so they are in good health for longer. And then number three, I think the power of technological advances that are coming in the NHS, whether it particularly in the AI space and starting with ambient listening, I think has the potential to completely transform our productivity levels so we can do much, much more work for the same amount of money.
What's been really interesting with our case studies is that quite a few of them actually haven't waited for the 10-year health plan to start moving care from hospitals into the community. We've seen some great examples of that. And from you've been on multiple trust visits, you've probably seen something similar. So why has it taken the wider NHS so long to catch up and kind of put this into action at a national level?
So I absolutely am loving the trust visits I'm doing. So we've got it into a little brief now where you go and visit a trust and you say, show me the thing that you're really proud of. And what's extraordinary is, A, the variety of the things that people are proud of, but also every trust, every provider has got an amazing story to tell about something. And almost certainly that story is something that's in the 10-year plan as well. And so it really does give me the belief that we can actually do this because the amount of change and transformation that is already happening is huge. And it's in part why people completely buy into the 10-year plan because it builds on what everyone has already been doing. So it's not surprising that it started somewhere, everywhere. And I think that's a good thing. It's likely to be a good recipe for success going forward. What we've got to get better at is sharing all the good practice and then finding a way of scaling it so that not everyone has to invent the same new thing. You can just say, it's really good over there, we're going to do that. And the NHS has been bad at that in the past. And what we've collectively got to do, and I think it's where NHS providers could really help, is galvanising large-scale service change across England.
Daniel Elkeleys, and there's more from him coming up when we've been through our case studies. So let's first look at Somerset NHS Foundation Trust, their development of neighbourhood health models, personalised care planning and proactive support for frailty and end-of-life care are all designed to reduce hospital admissions and improve community-based care. Their chief executive, Peter Lewis, told me how their approach had evolved.
We've sort of been on a journey for quite a number of years now. And if you go back to 2017, 2018, there were three foundation trusts in Somerset, two acutes and a community and mental health provider. And in that period, we've brought those organisations together so that now Somerset Foundation Trusts runs two acute hospitals, provides mental health services, community services for the whole of the county, and also, as you say, through Symphony Healthcare runs 16 GP practices. And the whole driver of doing that in a way was about how do we really focus differently on population health and how do we integrate care around the needs of population. So that was the thinking. And what and we've done a number of things in that time. We've not just been through an organizational change process, but certainly with Symphony, that's about 22% of that population of the system that we're covering. So that really gives us some scale in terms of delivery of general practice. And in particular, we're looking how do we integrate what we do in general practice with what we do in our community services so that we give a better, more joined up response to the local population, basically.
And that's really interesting because the changes you've been making absolutely predate the 10-year health plan. And it'll be really interesting to know kind of what the drivers were locally. Like, what were you seeing at that local level that you thought you had to take action? And that's now being kind of rolled out nationally, really, isn't it? So you were like with the theme of this podcast, trailblazers for that kind of that way of working.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because if you go back, we were in the world of STPs back in 2016 and working as a Somerset STP, Sustainability and Transformation Partnerships, I think they were called. The three organisations working with the CCG, it was really difficult because we weren't making any progress, and it almost felt like any one party had a right of veto over everything. So we could sort of agree at a very high level what we were trying to do for the population. When it came to doing anything, we couldn't get any traction. So it was sort of born out of some of that frustration, mm-hmm. in a way. And how can we really come together and commit to doing something different for the population? We had three organisations that were relatively small, so nobody really had the scale to sustain themselves as an organisation. So out of those conversations, we got into an alliance. Two of the organisations got together in an alliance, started working together with one executive team. And from there, it developed into, well, if we're going to really do this, we need to merge and we need to sort of step over that threshold in some ways and do something differently. And that's what happened. And I think you say that we're sort of trailblazing, but the things that are in the 10-year plan in some ways aren't new, are they? Care closer to home, prevention rather than treatment. I think the issue is about how do we do that and how do we make sure we've got the incentives aligned and people aligned to really pull in the same direction. And I think that's the bigger thing in a way. It's not the what, it's the how you're going to do it.
Mm. And you mentioned there the importance of the how and kind of getting the incentives right. So for colleagues across the country who may be embarking on something similar as part of the 10-year health plan and integrating, what advice would you give them?
So I'd be very clear what you're trying to achieve and why. So we very much set what we were trying to do in. It was about the population of Somerset. So that was at the centre of everything. And then for anything you want to do, because you can't do everything all at once, how do you align people around that? We had colleagues it was really interesting because, as I said earlier, we sort of formed an alliance to start with and tried to get the community and mental health services working with one of the acutes. And colleagues told us after the event that it wasn't until we said we were going to merge those organisations they really thought we were serious, because they didn't understand this alliance thing. What was all that about? When we said we're going to merge and we're going to be one organisation and we were serious about the population health element of this and putting the population at the centre, was when they really got on board. And then we had people coming to us. Like, I remember an example of the two dietetics leads, one from the community and one from the acute, coming to us and saying, we think we can do X, Y, and Z, which will be better for patients. And it was almost, once you've got that clarity of what you're trying to do, get people aligned and you get some momentum, and then we just ran with it, I guess.
And you mentioned there your dietetics colleagues, and like they thought they could actually make some real changes. And from the changes that you have made on the ground, like what differences are patients seeing kind of day to day in their care, and how are staff delivering services differently? Like, what changes are they seeing in their working lives?
Yeah. So I think this varies service by service and area by area in a way, because I wouldn't pretend that we've cracked this across the board. And I have described it recently. We've gone where the opportunities are and where the enthusiasm is, and we haven't necessarily taken a systematic approach. And now it's time to stand back and take a systematic approach, and how do we drive it more consistently? But I think we've got a number of examples where we've made a significant step change in what patients are experiencing. So one of them would be for young people with mental health difficulties who end up in an acute hospital. We have transformed that pathway. We've now got the acute paediatric team working with the CAMHS team, so they're working together for those individuals, basically. Whereas I think beforehand they didn't quite necessarily understand each other's perspective and were working against each other, sometimes blaming the other for what was happening to this young person. So in terms of the way we've been able to change those pathways, that means we don't get young people in our paediatric wards for extended periods of time who don't really need to be there. The CAMHS team will inreach into the paediatric service as well. So it comes back to what I said, it's about putting the patient at the centre of that and getting people to work together. And that's just one example. And we now have a joint management structure where CAMHS and acute paediatrics are part of the same service group within the organisation. It's not a mental health service and a physical health service that are separate and managed jointly as well. And there's other examples of that: stroke services, acute and community stroke services. We've done some really good work with our dermatology service, where we've now got an intermediate dermatology service, which is based in the community. They do a lot of work in community sites using GPs with specialist interest, which has really transformed pathways for patients and taken some of the pressure off of the acute service as well. So in various areas, we've made sure we bring people together, understand what the patients really need, and then think about how can those pathways be different.
It's so interesting, because you were talking there about CAMHS and like the pressure on children and young people's mental health services. We know that waiting lists and pressure on that particular service, and the kind of the way that you brought mental health and acute paediatrics together. Did you introduce anything in particular to try and overcome those barriers between different organisations? And again, coming back to kind of peer learning and lessons that could be learned, is there anything that you could share there, like any particular insights?
Yeah, I mean, the mental health and acute physical health services are really interesting, because you can imagine there was a lot of concern in our mental health services when we first were talking about this, because they felt they were going to be they were going to lose out. They were going to be come second to the acute services. So it was really important, I think, that we recognise that up front and said to people that we know that the investment in mental health services in Somerset was really poor. I think we were the fourth lowest spend per head on mental health services in the country when you looked at all of the systems. So we made some absolute commitments about parity of esteem in that, and that we're going to treat them equally. We were very clear that there is a we referred to it as stolen years, but effectively people with severe mental illness live up to 20 years less than those who haven't got severe mental illness. So we were really clear about that, and really clear that we wanted to address that investment imbalance. So there was something about setting our stall out at the very beginning and strategically saying, this is about people. It's not about physical health or mental health. It's about the people. Mm-hmm. And how do we make sure we address some of these imbalances that have been there before? And I think there was some skepticism, and we said it's not the words that make a difference, it'll be the actions. But I think our mental health services are in a much better place than they were back in 2017-18. We've won all sorts of awards for the work we've done in mental health, and particularly the work we've done with the voluntary sector during that time as well. So I think we've said what we were going to do, and then we've done some of that, which helps them build confidence in other places as well.
Peter Lewis there, setting out what's been done in Somerset. To Yorkshire now, and another example of integrated neighbourhood working using dedicated mental health vehicles and pioneering deployment of advanced paramedics and mental health. Let's hear from one of those advanced paramedics, Louise Whittaker, and Leslie Butterworth, who is Yorkshire Ambulance Service's Head of Nursing and Patient Experience. Louise told me how their approach had developed.
So in 2019, when the long-term plan was first published, there was quite a lot in there about the ambulance service and mental health. And it described things like mental health professional support to our emergency operations centre, that's where we take our 999 calls, training and education for all mental health, for all ambulance staff, sorry, and what was termed in that paper, mental health ambulances. So at that point, as a team of two, as we were then, I was tasked with writing a plan for Yorkshire Ambulance Service to say how we would meet the objectives that were set out. And that involved working with our commissioners, with our partners, with patient representatives to look at what was the art of the possible and what did those things mean to us. Out of the back of that, we had a comprehensive business case, which went to our board and our commissioners, that described things like a full day training for all of our ambulance staff. And within that, we talked about mental health response vehicles and started to really shape up our thinking in terms of mental health response vehicles and what they would be. Alongside that, there was also a national procurement exercise that was being led centrally by NHS England that was commissioning actual vehicles. So the two things segued really nicely together. And we got to the point that when that procurement exercise was ready to go and those vehicles were being produced, that we knew what our service delivery model would be for mental health response vehicles. And as part of that, we recruited Louise into her role as advanced paramedic in mental health, one of the first in the country. And we have then seen those vehicles become operational, and Louise can tell us a little bit more about what that means actually for our patients.
Over to you, Louise.
So we've got 9 vehicles now. When we first started, the first vehicle was at Hull. And I think it's fair to say that I wasn't with the Trust at the time, but I think it was fair to say that it was very new and people were quite perplexed by the idea of a mental health vehicle. But then we sort of gained confidence and traction and rolled it out to a couple of other areas in Yorkshire. We were assisted with a project manager to help us install those vehicles, so it can be quite complex. And we now have 9 across Yorkshire and Humber's footprint. All of those have been agreed with commissioners. So obviously we have very close relationships with our ICB partners to ensure that we're serving their patient needs and population needs really well, or certainly as far as we possibly can. And each vehicle, initially, the NHS England vision was that there would be a mental health nurse and a paramedic on each vehicle, but that proved to be really difficult to recruit to. Again, that was prior to me starting, but it was really difficult, and COVID didn't help. That was right in the middle of this NHS long-term plan. So we pivoted to the idea of looking at the enhanced practice route. There was an apprenticeship starting at Sheffield Hallam University. They were really interested in working with Leslie on creating a bespoke programme of education. And looking at the urgent care practitioners and the critical care practitioners, it's evident that paramedics can work really effectively at an enhanced and an advanced practice level. So we created the apprenticeship route with Sheffield Hallam University, and were then able to look at, you know, what do we want on mental health here? Because there's a couple of things we need. We need clinicians who are excellent at dealing with patients in mental health crisis. Obviously, the patient-clinician relationship is absolutely essential, and also with families and carers, they're also impacted. But I guess the other role for our enhanced practitioners, the education and research that they can bring, and the local working that they can bring to our workforce, which means that we can contact our work with other clinical support and paramedics within our organisation and sort of upskill them and help them and support them in dealing with patients in mental health crisis. So we've now got a team of 27. We've got a couple of vacancies to complete, and we're working on a clinical support model that suits them as well. Yeah, it's been really interesting.
And you mentioned there that when you first kind of put forward the proposal, that people were perplexed, and then you also faced kind of barriers and challenges in terms of the getting the workforce right. So you had to kind of go down the enhanced practice route. Were there any other challenges that you had to overcome, and what did you do kind of working with local partners to convince them of the need? Because clearly there was a need that had to be met within your local community for kind of a different way of working for patients with mental health needs.
I think at the outset, We had a lot of discussion around, like I said, it said mental health ambulances in the long-term plan, and lots of people thought that was purely about transport. So lots of discussion about secure transport, moving people from one mental health facility to another mental health facility. Lots of discussion around Section 136 of the Mental Health Act, where people have been detained in the community, bringing them in for a Mental Health Act assessment. And actually what we wanted to describe was this was much more about a workforce model as it was about the vehicle they were going to arrive in, although that was also important. So we heard from our patients time and time again that they didn't want a traditional ambulance with, you know, blue lights and sirens and lots of Battenberg on the side. When they're in mental health crisis, they want something that's much subtler, which is what the mental health response vehicles give us. As a nurse myself, I absolutely believe that having nurses on those vehicles in the early days was the right model. What we have shown is that paramedic practice is developing, and actually they are the experts in pre-hospital field. By giving them the skill set to be able to deal with people in mental health crisis in that setting is far more conducive to getting a good outcome for that patient than taking mental health nurses out of the mental health system where absolutely they need to be.
I think the ambulance service attracts people who want to be paramedics and they want to work in trauma situations, for example, or they want to be dealing with sick patients. And I think there are quite a large number of staff who are interested in mental health, but we need to bring it to life to our workforce. To say, you know, this is a career that would be really, you know, it gives you an opportunity to work with other agencies, to work in different ways, to give people with mental health issues genuinely better and improved care, getting them to the right place first time rather than taking them to A&E repeatedly and not getting the right treatment or service that they need. So I think that was a big challenge, to sort of bring mental health to light as a speciality. The initial recruitment was quite difficult, but we've had more than we needed in our applications after that. And it's a really popular role now, and I think we've got a really good team.
And some of the figures that we have seen have been quite striking in terms of the impact. So in 2023, 61% of patients seen by your mental health vehicles were supported at or close to home. And I think up to 600 frontline staff have had mental health response training. So what impact has this had on patients and staff more clearly? Like what changes are you seeing because of the changes that you've introduced within your trust?
We've seen in 24-25, we've seen about 11,000 patients, and we work across emergency care, as you'd expect from an ambulance service, if we're the closest resource, we will go to category one calls, so people in cardiac arrest or very seriously unwell. But we've seen around 9,000 patients in that time on the mental health response vehicles. I think the non-conveyance rate for that year was about 70%. And we work really closely with partner agencies like crisis teams and safe spaces. We have good knowledge of the local area to make sure that we can signpost people to their GP or to talking therapies. Or, for example, we have Turning Point in Wakefield, who are really good at self-referrals and get back to patients with substance abuse issues, for example. So I think we've talked about this as well, Leslie, about what is it that makes mental health paramedics more effective than an ambulance, a standard ambulance. And I think it's, for me, I think it's around the pathways that they have and the options that they can offer patients, and they have the confidence of going to actually speak to patients and hear what they're saying and see them in their difficulty and look at how we could improve that for them. Whereas I think if you only have the option of going to the emergency department, it creates a barrier between the clinician and the patient because they don't want to go to the emergency department. And generally speaking, it's not the right place for a lot of our patients. Having the confidence to use referral pathways and speak to other clinicians in mental health trusts and mental health support workers have been a revelation as well. It's definitely a game changer.
Louise Whittaker and Leslie Butterworth with a view on neighbourhood working from an ambulance perspective and how in Yorkshire they are helping to deliver a shift from fragmented hospital-centric care to integrated community-based preventative services. That's it for the first edition of our Providers Deliver mini-series. The second one, with two more trailblazing case studies for the 10-year health plan, is coming up soon. You can find summaries of the work highlighted in this series on the NHS Providers website, nhsproviders.org, where of course you can also see much, much more analysis and comment on the 10-year health plan and what's needed to ensure it delivers on its ambitions. A reminder, as always, that you can join in the conversation and subscribe to the podcast by following us on X at NHS Providers and LinkedIn with the hashtag The Provider Podcast. Thank you for listening.